Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have come to rely acutely on the great intelligence of our first guest. He is Joseph Heumeier, the executive director of a terrific organization, the Center for a Secure Free Society. He is a veteran of the United States Marine Corps, which he served for 8 years, including combat tours in Iraq and Liberia, as well as multinational training in Latin America. A very considerable resource, not least for his writings on mostly Latin America-related subjects, including his terrific book, Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America. It's good to have you back, Joseph. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us. Let me ask you about Iran's strategic penetration of Latin America, specifically with the passing, fortunately at our hands, of General Qasem Soleimani, who was essentially, I guess, the godfather of Hezbollah, Iran's foreign legion, for want of a better term, their terrorist cells and so on, now operating not just in Lebanon, but around the world, including, as you've established, in Latin America. Where are we with respect to those elements in our own hemisphere, as you see it, Joseph? And what, if anything, does the demise of Soleimani mean in terms of the threat that they pose to us?
Yeah, so Frank, first of all, I think the death of Soleimani really kind of lit up a lot of the attention worldwide on the Quds Force, on their connection to proxy networks, particularly Hezbollah, but also other proxy networks, particularly in the Middle East, but also in Africa and even in Latin America. What we saw in the immediate aftermath of his death was sentiments of solidarity by many entities within Latin America, most prominently the governments of Cuba and Venezuela, but also non-state actors such as the FARC in Colombia and these Islamic centers that Iran has propped up all throughout the region, all throughout Latin America. They did public condolences. They held 3 days of mourning. So it kind of woke up the Latin American press, you know, policy folks that are watching, that Soleimani was a major figure, even in Latin America, where no one really thought he would have a presence. And one of the reasons is because I think Soleimani, one of his lasting legacies in many respects is establishing this trans-regional network, the cohesiveness of this network, the ability to utilize that network as a weapon of warfare, asymmetric warfare. I think that was a lot of what Soleimani had done. Obviously, that was his mandate as the leader of the Quds Force and why he was so important to the Ayatollahs in Iran, because if their primary mission is to export the Iranian revolution worldwide, then Soleimani was their guy. He was the one that did it for at least the last 20 years, and that includes in Latin America.
Let me ask you, Joseph, because we'll run out of time before we have things to talk with you about, and I hope we can get you on soon for a proper hour-long discussion of all of this, because it's vitally important. How are, you say they were lit up by events that they did and so on. How did these Hezbollah units or cells manifest themselves in places like Latin America, and where in particular? You mentioned mosques. I assume that mostly it's under the auspices of the Iranian government itself, its embassies and so on. But what if you were looking for them, what would you be looking for?
Well, I think the first place you want to look at is, and I don't want to say that this is the entire entity of these communities, but Lebanese communities are really large in Latin America, particularly in countries like Brazil and the tri-border area, Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil, and the border of Venezuela and Colombia, in parts of Central America, Mexico, parts of Ecuador. So they've had these communities that are historic. And now this doesn't mean that Hezbollah controls these communities. Nonetheless, they've used these communities as a gateway to be able to infiltrate, to be able to come in to Latin America. First, under the guise of commercial companies and different type of business businessmen. But in the long run, we've learned that a lot of them have been involved in illicit activity. A lot of them were tied to Hezbollah. I think the complication of looking at Hezbollah in Latin America, I think this is why it gets a lot of people confused, is that it's layered. And Hezbollah has a clandestine arm, and their clandestine arm works much like any intelligence service, where you have cutouts, you have frontmen, you have individuals that you can't say with verifiable proof that they're part of the organization of Hezbollah, but they're definitely working at the service of Hezbollah. And I think in that, we find a lot of that in Latin America. I call those the fixers and the facilitators for Hezbollah in Latin America. And you find them first and foremost in the Lebanese communities all throughout the region.
As you look at this, and I'm going to ask you to be fairly succinct, Joseph Humeyer is a man who both has a military background and, you know, a national security sort of specialists. How serious a threat do you regard Hezbollah in our hemisphere to be? And we'll be talking shortly with Michael Cutler, who had a lot of experience trying to keep bad people out of our country, about the fact that they've gotten in to the United States as well. But starting with their presence south of our borders, the protection that they're getting from governments like Nicolas Maduro's of Venezuela, for example, and, you know, the Sandinistas and so on. I mean, what is the current state of the threat as you see it from Hezbollah units in this hemisphere?
Listen, just to be very succinct, Frank, if you're worried about the border, if you're worried about drug trafficking, if you're worried about terrorist infiltration, if you're worried about Venezuela, if you're worried about any of these problems that exist in the Western Hemisphere, you have to be worried about Hezbollah, because Hezbollah is attached to each one of those problem sets in different ways. Hezbollah is one of the few trans-regional networks that operates all the way from the Middle East to Africa to Latin America up into the United States. And they've mastered these elements of asymmetric war. So if you're worried about any of those elements, whether it's infiltration of the southern border, terror networks, high rise of drugs coming into the United States, and obviously the big crisis in Venezuela, Hezbollah is a major player in all of that. And I think the U.S. is coming to grips with that reality.
And in terms, just quickly, of the presence in our own country of these cells, is it your belief that they're good to go at any time if ordered by Tehran to engage in terrorist activities? And if you can, do we have enough knowledge about them here, do you think, to roll them up now?
So I think Hezbollah's clandestine arm, their external security organization, the 9th Unit 910, as the FBI calls them, they have presence absolutely in the United States. Just in the last year, there's been at least 3 cases of individuals, I think 2 from New York, that were casing, surveilling, targeting folks, targets in the United States that were connected to Hezbollah through this Unit 910. So I think they have this ability to launch a terror campaign worldwide if they choose to do so. I think Iran is calculating on a deterrent for that kind of activity. And I would look at their nuclear program, because they obviously have this nuclear capability that gives them a strong deterrent to unleash terror worldwide.
We have to leave it at that for the moment. Joseph Humeyer, there is, as I said, a lot more to talk with you about. And I think that the fact that you have put such a sharp focus on this enemy within problem, within our region for sure, and inside our own country as well, is an incredible public service. Thank you again for all that you do at the Center for a Secure Free Society. And once again, I commend to all of our listeners Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America, truly required reading, by Joseph Humeyer. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. God bless you in the meantime. Next up, we'll speak, as promised, with Michael Cutler about both what's happening with our borders, the coronavirus, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Michael Cutler, a veteran of the Immigration and Naturalization Services for over 30 years on the front lines of protecting our country against, well, a variety of threats we're accustomed to facing, sometimes not so accustomed to facing, like pandemics. I caught up with Michael's recent contribution to Front Page Magazine's coverage of the coronavirus and thought it would be good to take stock with him about what we're confronting in that regard and what our personnel who are standing watch at our borders are being exposed to and having to contend with. Michael, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Always great to join you, Frank. Thanks for having me on. I began my career with the Immigration and Naturalization Service way back in 1971 as an immigration inspector. I was assigned to John F. Kennedy International Airport. And what most people forget is that Ellis Island was a quarantine station. We worked shoulder to shoulder with U.S. public health officials. And in fact, in one occasion, I had a young man come into my booth, actually carried it to my booth. He must have been no more than 7 or 8 years old. By friends or family members, neighbors, I don't know, but it wasn't his parents. He was from the Caribbean, had a super high fever, was barely conscious, or I would say semi-conscious. When I put my hand on his forehead, I realized he had a high fever. I called my bosses over. An ambulance was dispatched. He was taken to a hospital, placed in quarantine, and I was told that he was at death's doorstep and that he had a highly contagious disease. And in fact, many of us at the airport contracted terrible diseases. I wound up in the hospital with 105 fever myself, over 105. So we have to remember that part of the immigration mission or the inspections mission at ports of entry is to prevent the entry of aliens with dangerous communicable diseases. And in fact, that is the first item on the list of aliens to be excluded under Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. What I find remarkable, contradictory, and a bit crazy is you have Cory Booker and Senator Menendez, both from New Jersey, demanding that we screen arriving passengers to make certain that they're not infected with the coronavirus, which is fine. I agree with it. But these are the same folks who don't want to secure the Mexican border or take other measures to make certain we know who's coming into the country. There is no inspections process, I would remind you, when people evade that process by running the border, stowing away on ships and so forth. We're really psychotic, if you want to say that, or our politicians are. They don't get it or they don't want to get it. We've got to protect ourselves, and you can't do it by having people sneak into the country.
So, Michael, just to drill down on this, because it's, of course, as you say, a problem for personnel who are manning the official border crossing checkpoints, and it's a problem for the Border Patrol that is trying to monitor the spaces in between. It's a problem for people in the interior of the country once these folks are getting in. How serious, I mean, set aside the coronavirus for the moment, but just how acute is the problem for public health of people who are coming in, whether it's from Latin America or it's from Africa or it's from some other parts of the world, with diseases that we no longer have in this country as a general rule, and that are potentially, as a result, considered dangerous to the public?
It's a huge problem. It's a problem because it could cause an epidemic in the United States. And here's the other part of the equation no one thinks about. Even if we have treatments for viruses and other such diseases, and we've seen a resurgence in a disease that resembles polio that have left children paralyzed, I mean, this isn't a joke. But if you stress the facilities, the ability you have to deal with sick people, and the third world doesn't do a very good job of taking care of their people, they are going to try to get to the United States to seek treatment. Under the law, emergency rooms can't delineate lawful immigrant, illegal alien from U.S. citizen. It's first come, first serve. So if we get inundated, let's say down in the border regions of the United States, because a lot of people are coming up from Latin America with diseases, by the way, if you flood the hospitals and overwhelm the capability of treating people, we run out of the antiviral drugs and so forth, this could cost Americans their lives. We want to be compassionate, but we don't want to get Americans killed. But again, nobody in the media is talking about how this impacts the safety and lives of Americans and people legally living in the United States. It's a huge problem.
Well, I have the feeling that's subject to change because this coronavirus, which we're hearing today after some somewhat encouraging reports that were coming out of the official Chinese sources yesterday, I frankly discounted them, but there they were. They give some sense that maybe this thing is beginning to slacken a bit in China. Now, there's reports that the numbers are kicking up because of some changes they've been making in the computations. But look, I don't think there's any doubt that what is happening in China is a massive problem for China, and it is being unleashed on the rest of the world. Inevitably, it will be coming here. So I imagine there will be, witness, Messrs. Booker and Menendez, a growing demand for attention to this. And hopefully, as you say, Michael Cutler will be focusing on it, not just, you know, at the border crossings. Let me ask you, though, what, as a, you know, a serious professional in this space, what can we be doing that we're not now to try to ensure that we're protecting the public safety in these border areas and beyond?
It comes back to interior enforcement also, obviously. It comes back to securing the border. But look, you know, I find it remarkable because President Trump was what has been referred to as Trump's travel ban was no travel ban, but an entry restriction. If anyone wants to see what a travel ban looks like, look at what's happening in China. Rail lines shut down, bus lines shut down, airports shuttered, movie theaters closed, shopping centers closed. That's a travel ban. So when the president takes reasonable action, and my second article, and you can find this at frontpagemag.com, and I hope everybody will, and then, you know, forward it to everybody you can, because it's about getting information out there, which is so difficult today. You look at how President Trump just last week said he was going to add some countries to the list of countries that we won't allow their citizens in with certain categories of visas out of national security concerns, certainly his authority to do that. Pelosi immediately attacked him and said he was acting illegally. He was going to undermine national security. It's un-American. The standard response is to attack the president who's trying to protect Americans. That has to stop. And you know, elections do have consequences. And if we can't keep terrorists out of the country, if we can't keep gang members out of the country, if we can't keep people who have dangerous diseases out of the country, we are in very deep trouble. And that's where we stand today. So I wrote this piece about how even after an individual was arrested in Arizona who was wanted for the murder of two police officers in Iraq and believed to be a leader of Al-Qaeda, living for 10 years in Arizona running a driving school. Think about that. Why is he here? Why Arizona? Perhaps he's facilitating the entry of terrorists through our southern border. The president on that very same day said, if we can't screen these people, they're not getting in. And Pelosi claims this somehow undermines our security. We're witnessing lunacy by people who are supposed to be our leaders.
Well, and I have to tell you, Michael, as we're both, I guess, career national security practitioners. This is crazy making to have in instance after instance after instance national security invoked as the charge against this president, whether it's on his dealings with Ukraine and the impeachment nonsense, or whether it's in this case where, if anything, the national security argues for doing exactly what he's doing. Listen, quickly, before we lose time with you, Michael, I did want to just ask you, and again, our guest is Michael Cutler. You can find his writings at Front Page Magazine, and he also has his own radio program, the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio on Fridays. Let me just ask you about something I talked about a short while ago with Joseph Heumeier. Hezbollah. In Latin America, he makes the case compellingly that it is. What's your current reading, both in terms of their ability to penetrate our border and their presence in our own country? Talk about national security problems.
Well, you know, I've written about this extensively at the Front Page Mag, and I've also done podcasts to Dennis Michael Lynch at dmlnews.com, Team DML. They're here, and we've had a whole bunch of them arrested over the years, and there's been hearing after hearing for well over a decade about sleeper agents being arrested in the United States. And it's interesting you raise the point, because today the Senate is going to take a vote on potentially limiting the president's power to use the military specifically against Iran. You know, it was the Democrats. I'm not being partisan. I'm a registered Democrat. These people are crazy. They're not Democrats. They're lunatics. You know, General Soleimani, who was the leader of the Quds forces operating throughout Latin America, believed to be involved in a plot to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States in Washington. And they're going crazy that we took out the leader of Hezbollah, who is the bomb maker, who's killed, I don't know how many hundreds of U.S. soldiers with his bombs. And now they're going to try to handcuff the president. It's a dangerous tactic. The country should be united behind the commander in chief, as he does everything rational and reasonable to protect us and protect our families.
Michael, we have to leave it at that. I do hope, if we're as confident as you seem to be about the presence of Hezbollah in our country, that we are doing everything we can to roll them up and put them out of business in this country, as well as in adjacent nations from which they might migrate here. Michael Cutler, again, thank you for your great service to our country, that you provided in the uniform of the Immigration and Naturalization Services, as well as that you are rendering today in places like Front Page Magazine and of course, on this program from time to time. Come back to us again soon if you would, sir. Next up, we will speak with David Goldman. We'll talk a bit more about the coronavirus, China, and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a delight to say, joined by a good friend and very important contributor to this program, David Goldman. He is, among other things, also known as Spengler, pseudonym, the nom de guerre, I think of it as, that he has adopted for splendid columns that he writes for the Asia Times. He's also the author of How Civilizations Die and a forthcoming book about Huawei, which we anxiously anticipate. David Goldman, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Let's talk a little bit about coronavirus, David. We have been hearing of late that the problem seems to be slackening somewhat. And then again today, we heard that it's actually seemingly continuing to intensify, particularly in the province in which Wuhan, the center of this outbreak, is located. What do you think is the ground truth at the moment, and can we rely on what the Chinese are telling us about it?
You could never rely on what the Chinese are telling us, but what appears to have happened is that the count of reported cases was raised by a very large margin because the Chinese began to count cases which they had ignored before. We know that there was a massive undercount of cases in the past, partly because they didn't have enough test kits, partly because the protein tests they were using gave false negatives in many cases, and partly because the compulsory quarantine in Hubei province, in Wuhan city in particular, has been so brutal, people have been left to die, that many people with the virus have evaded quarantine. And we're sure of that because the Chinese authorities have been denouncing people for evading quarantine, which means a lot of that's going on. According to teams at American universities who are tracking this carefully, what has happened is that the Chinese have now counted into the total number of coronavirus cases individuals where a chest scan indicated the presence of the virus, even though the test was negative. So the best guess we have at the moment is that although the total number of reported cases has increased, the rate of infection has slowed down somewhat. So the global pandemic, zombie apocalypse scenario that you read on websites like Zero Hedge does appear to be exaggerated, and the measures that the Chinese have taken with the full brutal authority of a totalitarian state, do appear to be slowing the spread of the virus. Of course, things could spiral out of control. Things could be a lot worse than we think, but that's the best estimate that I have from sources inside China, as well as at American epidemiology teams who are following this carefully.
I want to talk with you both about sort of the problem that arises from not being able to have much confidence in what the Chinese are telling us, and the degree to which that is shaking not just confidence, hopefully, on the part of people who don't have to live under the regime, but also those who do. You've written about this at lawliberty.org, David Goldman. Give us a sense of the credibility of Xi Jinping's regime at the moment with its own people as well as others around the world.
Well, the Chinese regime took a severe hit in credibility because it responded too little and too late to a disease that could have been diagnosed in mid-December, but really wasn't addressed until after the first week of January. According to people I've talked to in Beijing who are in touch with the leadership, provincial officials, typically in an authoritarian regime, didn't want to send bad news up the chain of command because you don't get promoted by reporting bad news. So a good deal of the problem was covered up. You have the scandalous situation of Dr. Li, who mentioned the problem on social media, was then visited by police, forced to sign a confession that he disseminated false news, turned out to be exactly right, and tragically died of the disease. And this created a outpouring of outrage in China. Now, the only justification that the communist regime can give to its people for its authoritarian power is the idea that a meritocratic elite can act more quickly than a slow-moving democracy, that their management skills are superior. In this case, they disappointed enormously. So they're scrambling to reestablish their credibility. And I believe that the extreme measures that they took, locking down 150 million people, something which is practically unimaginable of a democracy, was not simply a medical measure. It was a political gesture to show that the regime has total power and everybody better get out of its way. That said, I think unless things are much worse than they look, the regime will in fact survive this, bleeding and bruised. But I don't believe that the virus outbreak as such is going to be sufficient to bring down the regime. There are many people who hope for that. As I wrote in the Law and Liberty piece, a lot of Americans view China like the Martian invaders in H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, who come and take over the Earth and then are destroyed by the common cold virus. It's not going to be so easy to rid ourselves of a serious strategic opponent.
Let me ask you, just as you have sources on the ground inside of China, your team, of course, at Asia Times reports extensively on what's going on there. How, just mechanically, does a lockdown of 150 million people persist? I mean, how are those people being fed? You know, how are they being sustained? I'm not talking about the people who are contagious or sick, but I'm just talking about the people who are sheltering in place, as they say, in this case, at the diktat of the state.
We have no indication there are food shortages. There are certainly important shortages of medical supplies in Hubei province and other places where the disease is at its peak. I'm told the situation in many Chinese cities, including Beijing, is spooky. These enormous boulevards, which crisscross the city, are practically empty. Everyone's working remotely. In Hong Kong, for example, my colleagues say their kids are sitting in front of a computer screen being instructed by teachers using teleconferencing apps. The first week, this is sort of a new toy, but it's gotten kind of difficult as things go on. In fact, Hong Kong just announced last night that schools would continue to be closed to the middle of March. However, I'm also told that people are being sent to work in factories starting on Monday. They think things are sufficiently controlled to do that. A lot of home delivery services, a lot of teleconferencing are more or less keeping things going. Probably we'll see the rate of Chinese economic growth drop very low during the first quarter. J.P. Morgan is talking about a 1% growth rate during the first quarter, followed by a rebound to, say, a 9% growth rate in the second quarter. That's J.P. Morgan's estimate. It's pretty much guesswork at this point.
Let me ask you about this factories point, David. I have been told that Chinese people are simply not turning up at the factories, even though they're open, even though they're being told they have to get back to work, that many of them are not operating even so because their employees are simply not in place. Are you hearing any of that at all?
A lot of the factories have, in fact, been shut, and I don't think we'll have a clear estimate on that scale of the problem until next Tuesday, when we see what happens on Monday, when most of the factories are being reopened and people are being sent back to work.
Still watching that closely, as I know will you. Let me ask you one other question, if I can, David, because you mentioned medical supplies shortages are now evident. Peter Navarro, who is a key advisor to President Trump, of course, in connection with his trade policies, the architect, I think it's fair to say, of the tariffs that have been used with great effect against China by the president, was on one of the television programs the other day, I think it was CNBC, talking about the fact that we ourselves may have shortages in medicines and perhaps other medical supplies because we rely upon China to supply them to us. And if they're having shortages at home, it's a safe bet, as they, I think, have indicated they would. They're meeting their own needs first. A colleague of ours on the Committee on the Present Danger, China, Rosemary Gibson, has written a terrific book on this subject, as you know, China RX, it's called, in which she warns that we are extraordinarily dependent upon China for generic medications especially, but also the active ingredients in a lot of prescription drugs, for penicillin, for vitamin C. We did a poll, as I think you know, last week, in which we sampled the opinion of 1,000 likely voters. It's available at presentdangerchina.org, and established that many of them were quite dependent themselves on prescription drugs and had no idea that that meant that they were dependent upon China's supply. And they were quite concerned about it when they were informed of it. What do you think is likely to happen in this regard if there is, in fact, diminished, you know, factory production and supply from China?
I think Peter DeVere and Rosemary Gibson are absolutely right to flag this to our attention. I think it shows the absurdity of the classical liberal position, which is that let the Chinese do all the manufacturing and we'll do all the design and we'll have Ricardian comparative advantages, which will be great. And those Ricardian and comparative advantages work, of course, until there's a crisis or a strategic problem, in which case, if we can't produce things that are vital to the U.S. economy, we'll be in terrible trouble. And I would add that not only medical supplies, but very large number of defense-related goods are coming from Asia, totally outside of our control, including most of the computer chips that we use. So if there was any event that flags to our attention the need for the kind of industrial policy which has a national security focus in terms of self-sufficiency on critical inputs to our economy and our general welfare, this would be it. So I think Navarro's warning in this case is spot on.
Peter is a good friend and a great leader, I think, on this subject, and we hope to have him on at some point to talk about it as well. But we're very pleased of your time, David Goldman, as always, as well as the clarity of your warnings on this subject, among others. Come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, we will speak with David Wormser, a colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, about anti-Semitism and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined, I'm ecstatic to say, by a new colleague at the Center for Security Policy. He has been a colleague for many years, but he is newly ensconced as the senior analyst and director of the center's newly established Combating Anti-Semitism and Defense of Israel project. His name is David Wormser. He rose to the ranks of lieutenant commander in the United States Navy Reserves, specializing in intelligence matters. He has been a senior Middle East advisor to the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, but also a special assistant to John Bolton, several of his previous incarnations. He is most welcome as a guest on this program, and in particular because we had a program that he presided over yesterday that I'm very excited to talk with him about. David Wormser, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I think this is our first time. If not, it's long overdue for sure. Good to have you with us. Welcome back. Let's talk first and foremost about this panel discussion that you officiated at yesterday at the Center for Security Policy. It was live streamed, and I believe the video of it is at our site now, securefreedom.org. Tell us who else participated and what you took away from it all.
Well, we also had Maya Carlin, who's an analyst here at the Center for Security Policy as well. She's also a master's student at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya in Israel in counterterrorism. So she wears a few hats herself. And, of course, the featured speaker was Elon Carr, who is the special envoy for monitoring and combating anti-Semitism globally in the U.S. Department of State, and a political appointee in this administration. So he's quite an asset to the administration, but it was a wonderful honor to have him visit us yesterday at the Institute and to host and participate in this panel.
And the subject was anti-Semitism, of course. What were the most important insights as you saw them coming out of it?
He covered some ground that is generally understood, that there are three basic sources or three baskets that are generating this unfortunate rise in anti-Semitism, that being this ethnic supremacism, which he loosely described as toward the right, although not fully comfortable with that designation, the hatred of Israel that is coming from the left, and the rise of Islamism and the sources that provides for hatred of Israel and then by extension, and even beyond that of Jews. And he then went to some length to say why he believes this hatred of Israel should be understood in the form of BDS and others as a form of anti-Semitism. He said and reminded us that the creation of Israel was the aspiration of the Jewish people for thousands of years. The advocacy of its destruction is to deny a fundamental element of what is Jewish identity and Jewish belief for so many years. And second of all, it's outright a call for genocide. So while criticism of Israel is legitimate, the call for its destruction and its delegitimization as a nation is not. It's a form of anti-Semitism, covering as anti-Zionism and criticism.
And there are some who would have us believe that it's okay if it's just anti-Zionism or anti-Israel sentiment, but it isn't. It really is of a piece with these other horrific, you know, sentiments and practices of anti-Semitism.
Absolutely, Mr. Carr outlined some other issues, which is essentially that when you hold Israel to a double standard, you hold a Jewish community to a double standard, or quite frankly, an impossible standard to which Western democracies don't even hold themselves, that ranges into a double standard, which has a different name, which is anti-Semitism. So he was very, very particular about that, to take off the table this argument one hears, well, are we not allowed to criticize Israel? He addressed that issue squarely in front and full center. Then he went to the issues of addressing anti-Semitism. How does one confront it? And of course, the first thing he said is what every government is claiming it's doing, which is to provide safety and security for Jewish communities. That's a sine qua non. But then he went on, and he described two other areas. One was the internet, and he called it the vector. It was where hatred is vectored. And by that, he compared it to the way children of yesteryear would wander or would be exposed to a neighborhood that was filled with drugs and violence. And he said, look, every parent forbid their children to go into that neighborhood because that neighborhood would rope them into the climate of drugs and violence, and it would corrupt them, and their sense of belonging or youth anxiety would drag them in and capture them. So the internet is really very much like that, and that issue has to be addressed. And it's everywhere. It's easy access, and it gives a home to kids who have no natural anxieties, and then that home captures them into a dangerous direction. He also then, again, outlined very carefully that there are forms, the First Amendment you know, gives people the right to speak, even speak awfully. But there's a difference between the right to have opinions that are offensive and the right to incite to commit crimes. And much of the anti-Semitic language on the internet is ranging into a call to violence against Jews. It's incitement, outright incitement, and has led and is leading to violence. That is prosecutable. Having a terrible idea is not. He recognizes that.
This is an important point, of course, for those of us who very much believe in free speech and its practice and are constantly at risk of being shut down ourselves because we exercise it in ways that other people find offensive.
And he was very insistent on that, that he's not seeking to amend the amendment or to limit it, but simply to address the issue of incitement, which leads to crime. He also, a third area was education. He said there's a creeping anti-Semitism that you do see in the curriculum and in the education system. He said it's not enough to educate people out of anti-Semitism. There's been a philo-Semitic nature to the American idea since its inception. It's been a very nice and favorable country to Jews, very tolerant and very welcoming. And the history of the Jewish and American experience together has been a very happy one generally, and a very good one that's been productive for both sides, so that the education system should really also focus on how rich and interactive and positive the experience has been for both sides, as sort of a philo-Semitic education curriculum.
It is striking that of late, it seems, there are a lot of people of Jewish extraction who have been quite vociferous in their condemnations of the United States, which, as you say, David Wormser, is against interest, I think, one might say, and certainly counterfactual with respect to their own historical contributions to this country and the appreciation of them. This is an unhappy sort of corollary to some of the anti-Semitism that seemingly emanates from self-hating Jews, I'm afraid.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is self-destructive. There's no other way to put it. It's self-destructive, and it's baffling to many of us.
Baffling and problematic, I think, in terms of the long-term future of the party that is most closely associated with them, and the sentiment that I revered from my time working for a great Democratic senator by the name of Scoop Jackson, in which the love of Israel and its protection was a truly bipartisan proposition. David Wormser, we didn't get anywhere near the other thing I wanted to talk with you about, which is the deal of the century. We'll have to have you back next week if we could. It's another topic that's very important, and we appreciate this extraordinarily rich description of the program that was aired yesterday. You can find it at securefreedom.org, featuring its moderator, David Wormser, and the special envoy on anti-Semitism of the State Department, and our colleague, Maya Karlan. Thank you so much, David. Be talking to you. Have a good weekend. I hope the rest of you will do the same and come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.